is the RTE News at 1 with Brian Dobson. Good afternoon. The headlines this lunchtime. A search is resuming for the bodies of six construction workers presumed dead after the bridge collapse in the US city of Baltimore yesterday. People are being urged to travel safely over the Easter bank holiday weekend, a period of high risk for death and injury on the roads. And the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has been chairing his last scheduled cabinet meeting before his departure from office next month. The news in detail now with Brian Jennings.
The emergency services in the US city of Baltimore are resuming a search for six construction workers who fell into the water after a container ship hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge in the early hours of yesterday morning. The six construction workers are presumed dead. Rear Admiral Shannon N. Gilreath of the US Coast Guard told reporters why the operation had changed from search and rescue to recovery.
Based on the length of time that we've gone in this search, the extensive search efforts that we've put into it, the water temperature, that at this point we do not believe that we're going to find any of these individuals still alive.
The bridge collapsed after a container ship lost power and crashed into it. Investigators from the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board have boarded the ship and recovered its data recorder. It's hoped the information on the recorder will help to explain why the vessel lost power shortly before impact. Gardaí investigating the deaths of three people in a road crash in County Mayo yesterday have made contact with their next of kin. A woman in her 30s and two of her children died when the car in which they were travelling was in collision with a truck. The incident happened on the N17 near Claremorris yesterday afternoon. Gardaí said the woman's husband is working abroad, but that he has now been informed of the deaths. Arrangements are being made for him to return to Ireland. The body of a man in his 30s was found in Dalkey in County Dublin yesterday morning. It's understood he'd been sleeping rough in the village for some time. The local coroner has been notified. He's believed to be the third rough sleeper found dead in Dublin this year. Gardaí and the Road Safety Authority have launched their Easter bank holiday road safety appeal. While all users are being urged to travel safely, particular emphasis is focused on cyclists. The appeal is being made as the latest figures show that 54 people have lost their lives on Irish roads so far this year, up 12 on the same period last year. It's the highest number of road deaths to have been recorded in the first quarter of a year over the past decade. Samantha Lebrary reports.
Last Easter, five people were killed and 18 were seriously injured. Launching their bank holiday appeal, the Road Safety Authority are also calling on drivers to give space to cyclists when overtaking and to slow down while doing so. In 2023, 9 cyclists were killed and 216 were seriously injured. And over the 4 years from 2018 to 2022, 1,327 cyclists were seriously injured on Irish roads. The vast majority were men. Most serious injuries occurred on urban roads and half of those incidents were recorded in Dublin.
The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has been chairing his last scheduled cabinet meeting ahead of the expected election of Simon Harris as his successor next month. Mr. Varadkar said on a rough count it was his 650th cabinet meeting. He said that his successor would have a tough job deciding who would stay in any cabinet reshuffle.
Rather than giving Simon Harris advice, you know, what I'd just ask other people in the parliamentary party to give him a fair go. There are lots of people who are going to be disappointed, and that's just the nature of these things. Don't take it personally. Knuckle down, work hard, and as I've probably helped to demonstrate in the past couple of weeks, opportunities arise in politics all the time.
The Economic and Social Research Institute has upgraded its outlook for economic growth this year amid an expected moderate expansion of the domestic economy. The Institute is forecasting that household incomes will increase this year as inflation falls back to more normal levels. Our business editor, Will Goodbody.
In its first quarterly economic commentary this year, the ESRI forecasts the domestic economy will grow by 2.3% in 2024, up from the 2% it predicted in December. The think tank also estimates that, fueled by falling inflation, possible interest rate cuts and a strong labour market, the wider economy as measured by GDP will expand by 2.5% this year, up slightly from its last prediction. The labour market is also likely to continue performing at levels close to capacity, it says, with unemployment set to average 4.3% this year. Consumer prices will continue falling, the research also suggests, with inflation set to average 2.3% across the year, and this coupled with rising wages will result in a return to growth in real household incomes. The ESRI also expects the public finances to continue to be strong, but ahead of the start of the budgetary cycle and a possible election later this year, it's cautioned that the government will have to balance investing in needed infrastructure while at the same time not overheating the economy through potential tax cuts.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant. Building a new home? Choose Grant's A++ rated Airona heat pump and Uflex underfloor heating. Visit grant.ie.
Showers will become more isolated this afternoon. There'll be sunny spells. Some showers may continue to be heavy, thundery and wintry on higher ground. Highest temperatures will range from 5 to 8 degrees. And there's a warning that easterly winds will reach gale force 8 at times on coastal waters from Rossan Point to Bloody Foreland to Fairhead. Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Still to come this lunchtime, new EU immigration rules and fresh plans to accommodate asylum seekers here. We'll get the latest from this morning's cabinet meeting with government and opposition reaction to the planned changes. An appeal to motorists to slow down from the senior Garda officer in charge of roads policing. Inside the IRA, a rediscovered film showing Martin McGuinness preparing a car bomb, Belfast gun battles and provos in training and why it was never shown. And a new service to help track down elderly Irish immigrants who've lost contact with home.
Make real savings at Supervalue with great Easter special offers like selected Cadbury, Old El Paso, Kellogg's, Heinz and Lore ranges, any 3 for €9. Exclusive to Real Rewards members only. Plus, money off vouchers every week on the app. Pop in store online for real savings at Supervalue. T's and C's apply.
Hi, I'm Dermot Bannon and I will be volunteering my time as part of the RIAI Simon Open Door event. This is a fantastic opportunity to get an architect's advice for a building or renovation project for a donation of €120 to support the work of the Simon communities in tackling homelessness. Book your consultation now on RIAISimonOpenDoor.ie.
The Lotto jackpot is an estimated €6 million. Responsibly in store, in app, or at lottery.ie. The National Lottery. It could be you.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. The incoming Taoiseach Simon Harris says Ireland needs to move away from an emergency response to migration and create a planned and sustainable solution. Speaking to reporters, the new Fine Gael leader said today that two policies before Cabinet are key to Ireland's future plans. A new EU immigration pact, he said, would mean that if you have the right to stay, then this will be agreed quickly. He said a separate policy by Minister for Integration Roderick O'Gorman would help address concerns among some communities that they are not being listened to in terms of migration accommodation.
We need to move beyond the emergency response to the migration crisis and try to get to a planned and sustainable system. And really I see the two proposals being brought forward by my colleagues today as an important step in that direction. On the justice side, recognising that this island needs to work with other European countries, recognising that there need to be rules in place across the EU, recognising that we have to be better when it comes to processing times, that we have to give people a quicker answer. If you have a right to stay, that's great and you should be integrated. And if you don't, you need to leave and you need to leave quicker. So I think the Migration Pact offers a real opportunity in relation to that. Of course, it will go before the Dáil and the Seanad, and I welcome that too. But I think it's an important step in the right direction in terms of having that rules-based system and a rules-based system across the European Union. On the accommodation side, similarly, we have to move from emergency. We have to move from communities feeling that their voices aren't being heard to actually being able to say to people, hang on, here's the plan. It's going to take a bit of time to get here, but here is what we want to do. And I very much welcome the approach being taken in this plan that we'll see an effort to have less reliance on the private market, less reliance on and often communities feeling that a facility that is really important to them and their community is being taken out of use for the purpose it was intended to be put into emergency use. So looking forward to the discussion at Cabinet today, two important proposals, and from my point of view, these are steps in the right direction to having that firm but fair approach that we need to migration in Ireland.
The Fine Gael leader Simon Harris speaking there before this morning's Cabinet meeting, which is ongoing. Let's talk to our political correspondent Micheál Lehane. Micheál, first of all, what do we know about this plan being brought forward by Minister for Integration Roderick O'Gorman to try and tackle the very significant issues in terms of accommodating asylum seekers?
This seems to be really focused on trying to ensure that in the future, when it comes to providing that accommodation, that it will be state-owned, that there will be less reliance on the private sector, which stands at about 96% at the moment when it comes to international protection applicants. And the way to do that, government are looking at, is building modular homes, which can be done quite quickly on state-owned land. Also looking at things like offices that are in place at the moment. Could they be converted relatively quickly into a place where people could be accommodated? And then there is that issue and that sensitivity that Simon Harris was alluding to there in certain communities around the country when it comes to facilities, particularly in relation to hotels in smaller and medium-sized towns. There seems to be a commitment in this plan that when it comes to the final hotel in any town, that that wouldn't be used for accommodating asylum seekers in the future. That would be left in place in those communities. I suppose all of this really coming off the back of a growing sense of anxiety within government facing into the local and European elections around its hand of the migration issue.
Now, separately but not unconnected, there is this proposal being brought to Cabinet by Minister of Justice Helen McEntee in relation to Ireland opting in to the EU's new Asylum and Migration Pact.
Yes, this is a significant development as well. And at the core of this pact seems to be a move towards ensuring that if someone comes from a second country, someone who has sought asylum elsewhere, and that that is a safe country, that they could be returned far more quickly than is the case at the moment. There are also moves in it to increase the level of security checks and screening. It says too that if people are unlikely to be granted asylum, that their application could be dealt with quite swiftly indeed. And it seems that they will be legally binding timeframes set out in this pact where people have to receive a decision. Now, of course, while some decisions are being kind of approved relatively quickly over 6 days, they've been 60 days they've been dealt with at the moment, there still have been many cases where people have had to wait up to 2 years for a decision. This pact, but it will take time to be introduced, is aiming to bring a new swiftness to all of that.
Right. And will this have to come before the Dáil, Micheál?
I believe this will require approval, and the feeling already among some in the opposition parties is not welcoming. It seems Sinn Féin's David Conlan in the last while urging the government not to sign up to the pact in its entirety, saying that it would take away some of the national sovereignty around the migration issue and around how each government handles it. And he says that is something that government shouldn't move towards.
Right. One other issue at Cabinet this morning, you've been reporting the last little while, Cabinet approval for devolving power to introduce traffic congestion charges to local authorities.
Yes, this is about sustainable transport and about a congestion plan for the future. It does look like that at some point, now the strategy that Winter Cabinet talked about, the medium to long term, but that there would be legislation introduced that would give guidance to local authorities, giving them ultimately the power to decide whether or not they wanted congestion charges, but it would be based on what other alternative transport is available. So that does seem to move in that direction, albeit not very quickly. There are other things in the plan too when it comes to fuel, when it comes to things like diesel, that there would be a review of taxes and in the future other options drawn up around taxation, which would be based on the polluter pays principle, which does seem to open the door to higher taxes on things like diesel in the future.
Very good. Micheál Lehane, thank you for that. Well, let's return to those planned changes onto that EU pact in relation to emigration, because we're joined by the Fine Gael Justice Spokesperson in the Shannon, Senator Barry Ward, and by Matty McGrath, Leader of the Rural Independents. You're both very welcome to News at One, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Perhaps I'll come first to you, Matty McGrath.
Thanks, Brian.
You're saying that this is a pact which we shouldn't be ratifying. Why?
I say that very strongly because it's stacked against us like a small country, but our GDP is going to be assessed, you know, so the value, how much we pay for people who we don't keep is going to be assessed on our GDP. We're lucky that our GDP is very strong, but that's thanks to very, very many multinationals that could change any time. So the monetary situation is going to have, you know, disastrous effect on our economy if we're sending people back, not taking people, but we're paying the 20,000 per person we don't take. And as well as that, I believe we need more time at this. This apparently needs to be signed by the, a decision taken by the end of March. Here we are in the last days of March and the government cabinet is discussing it. No time for a Dáil debate. Dáil isn't back until the 7th of April. So we need proper scrutiny, proper debate and proper answers from Minister Gorman and from Minister of Justice as well.
On the face of it though, this does seem like a set of proposals which, if anything, tighten rules, migration rules.
We've heard that before. We've been hearing that, Brian, with due respect, for a long, long time. And we all know cases, you heard me all there saying, referring to them. Most of the cases are taking 2 years. Some of them are taking much, much longer. And centres and people are incarcerated. The system isn't fit for purpose. And by passing the, or signing this pact, won't deem it fit for purpose overnight. We need a whole root and branch review of what's going on here, but we can't sign up to this treaty without any debate. Remember, under the Lisbon Treaty, and the second time, Lisbon 2, gave us the right, you know, the people, us the right to opt out of these decisions. And I'm pleading with this government, after getting such a resounding kind of no vote in the referendum, much of it to do with immigration, that they respect the will of the people in Lisbon too, and the promises that were made there and the inherent constitutional guarantees that were given there through that vote to opt out of treaties like this. We're Ireland, for God's sake. We don't have to be in unison with Europe. And the other problem we have, we don't have enough safe countries designated. We have way fewer than most of our colleagues. So I believe this is unconstitutional in relation to Lisbon.
Let's get a reaction to that from Senator Barry Ward. Also Sinn Féin Barry Ward today coming out against certainly aspects of this pact, saying that it represents EU overstep of its remit into areas of Irish sovereignty, and it must be, they say, for an Irish government to decide on key aspects of our immigration system. Why is the government saying this is a pact which we should be opting into in its entirety?
Well, I think the first thing, Brian, is that this is all about streamlining and improving the efficiency of the process that hasn't worked in many respects, although it would correct many of the things Matty has said. And unfortunately, Matty doesn't have much credibility on this issue. But the reality is, he said most cases are taking more than 2 years. In fact, we've brought that down to under a year, and people coming from safe countries can expect to have their application dealt with within 90 days. So Minister McEntee has invested huge resources in the International Protection Office to help them process applications more quickly. But this is a system that allows us to plug into all kinds of other systems within the European Union, and perhaps more importantly, to create legally binding timeframes for the government to deal with applications for international protection, so the people who come here will have a decision faster, they will know whether they have permission to stay or whether they're going to have to go home or not.
Do we have to sign up to an EU pact to have, on our own account, legally binding timeframes?
We don't, but we do have to sign up to a pact to have access to all of the other resources and the solidarity measures that are contained within it. That includes everything from increased border protection applications, it increases the access to the Eurodac database. It allows us then also to treat people who come here having already applied for asylum in another European country and to reject that application in a very quick time frame at the border. And these measures particularly have new mandatory border procedures that will allow us to do that. So what the reason we're signing up to this is actually to increase the efficiency, to improve the timeframes that Matty is complaining about, and actually deliver a better service for everybody involved, including the people who are coming here actually seeking protection.
Matty McGrath?
That doesn't stand up at all, and I take no lectures from Senator Ward about my credibility. We know the credibility of the government, but it's entitled on this issue. They're rushing and racing now with a new Taoiseach coming in, and wish him well, but to try and regain some of that lost ground, it's been totally haphazard, the whole attitude to this. And Barry hasn't addressed it at all. The huge cost that's going to be put on the taxpayer because of our GDP and related to this issue, you know, of the monetary payments for people we don't take. So Barry is, and he's talking about the minister investing time and money. Yes, she has, but the system is not fit for purpose by any make, shape or form. And that's not Matty McGrath's award. That's a word from NGOs and different people involved in this system as well.
If the figure is 20,000 into this pot, if you like, for those who are turned away, and that's hardly something that's going to drain our public finances.
But depends on the numbers. I mean, depends on how much. It doesn't belong adding up. I mean, who says the figure will stay at 20,000? And it's just a pact that we're signing up to here. Like everything else this government has done, sign up to anything Europe asks. Under the Lisbon Treaty, I repeat, it's unconstitutional. In my opinion, I'm not a liar, but in my opinion, it's unconstitutional. Barry, we're not respecting the will of the people in this, and we must respect the will of the
Barry
people.
Barry Ward, what about that question of cost? Yeah.
There are a couple of issues. First of all, Matty says we sign up to anything Europe asks. Of course, that's not the case. And this is the government, remember, that maintained an open border with Northern Ireland and convinced the European Union to support us in that regard. But the reason I say Matty lacks credibility on this, and the same applies in relation to the cost involved, and of course it depends on the numbers, whether we're in the pact or not. He said, for example, people are incarcerated awaiting decisions. That is not true. He said applications are taking more than 2 years for most people. That is not true. This is a man who talked about a colonisation and a plantation of our country by people seeking international protection.
Maybe I can stick to the issue.
That's why I say he hasn't got the credibility.
What
is the potential cost here, or is it a blank check?
Well, it's neither. In fact, it's anticipated that signing up to this pact will save us money because it will reduce the time frames, which means that people will be in state accommodation here for a lesser period of time. It also mandates to put in place dedicated accommodation for those who are being processed in border procedures so that we're not relying on the private sector. And if we reduce the number of people who are waiting here, then we will also reduce the bill for accommodating them around the country. Mm-hmm. So the one thing that Matty is talking about really is the solidarity mechanism that allows us to make a financial contribution in lieu of taking somebody in here. That, as I understand it, is fixed at 20,000 euro. He's right in saying that it depends on the numbers, but that's irrespective of whether we're in the pact or not.
Just a question in relation to who else is or isn't signing up to this. Denmark won't be joining this pact. Isn't that right, Barry Ward? They've presumably looked at this and they feel that this is something that does impinge on their sovereignty.
Yeah, and that is, of course, their prerogative. But I feel if we stay out of this pact, we're doing exactly what Britain did and said, let's stand alone. And we are eschewing the access to all of the facilities, the solidarity measures, the databases, the resources and the supports that are available through being part of this pact. Ireland is a small country, as has been pointed out. We are much better off plugging into the mechanisms and the supports that are available through the pact and through our continued membership of the European Union.
We'll leave it there. Barry Ward and Matty McGrath, thank you both for talking to us. The N17 around Claremorris in County Mayo has reopened to traffic after yesterday's fatal collision there in which three people died. The deceased, a woman understood to be in her 30s, and two of her children, all died when the car they were travelling in collided with a truck. A Garda forensic examination of the crash site concluded earlier. Our Western correspondent, Pat McGrath, has the latest on this. Well, what about this investigation, Pat? What, if anything, is emerging about how this occurred?
Well, the investigation still progressing. Gardaí have made contact with relatives of the three people who died in that traffic collision near Claremorris. It's understood the woman's husband is working abroad at present, which complicated efforts to alert him yesterday evening, Brian. But this afternoon, Gardaí confirmed he has now been informed of the tragedy and arrangements are being made for him to return to Ireland. The family in question lived in County Galway. Now, the scene around the crash site at Castlegar was preserved overnight, and that forensic examination by Garda technical experts resumed at first light this morning. It concluded shortly before 11 o'clock when both lanes of the N17 reopened to traffic. Now, detectives investigating the exact circumstances surrounding the tragedy have again appealed for witnesses or motorists with dash cam footage that might assist the inquiry to come forward. Post-mortem examinations expected to be carried out at Mayo University Hospital on the remains of the three deceased. They were taken from the crash scene to the hospital in Castlebar last evening.
Yeah, obviously a lot of reaction to the tragedy in Mayo. Pat, coming so soon after the deaths of those two people in that house fire in Swinford.
Yeah, there's a huge feeling of sadness locally. As you say, it came just a couple of hours after that house fire in Swinford in which two people died. Investigations into that blaze, which destroyed the two-storey home of Tom and Eileen Mahon, are continuing. The Cathaoirleach of Mayo County Council described yesterday as one of the darkest days ever seen in the county. And I think that's a summation that many people will share in the aftermath of Tuesday's events. Michael Loftus said it had been a horrifically black day for County Mayo after the deaths in Swinford and Claremorris, and that the hearts of people in the region went out to the bereaved families. Now, the Assistant Garda Commissioner for Roads Policing, Paula Hillman, today appealed to people to slow down on the roads ahead of the Easter bank holiday weekend. Following the tragedy in Mayo, she said Gardaí would be out in force over the coming weekend, tackling offences that are known to cause death and serious injuries.
Certainly, you know, our thoughts are with the family and communities of those who have been so tragically impacted by that collision yesterday, and so many collisions throughout this year. We're coming up now to Easter, to the bank holiday, and you know, we will be starting our road safety operation, and we just again remind everybody, please slow down. Just if everyone slows down, lower the speed on the road, and drive. Think of the weather conditions as well. You know, it's cold, it's wet. Think of the weather conditions and drive within, you know, what you see, not just the speed limit, drive, you know, in line with the road conditions and the weather conditions you're experiencing.
And we've had a very heavy toll on the road so far this year.
We have. And I mean, we are totally committed, you know, as the National Policing Service, you know, our roads policing, our regular members, we will be out there, you know, tackling and enforcing those offences we know cause that death and serious injury on our roads. You know, we arrest one person on average every hour for drink or drug driving. That's one person an hour. We issue two tickets every hour for people using their mobile phone. The guards, we issue at least four tickets for people exceeding the speed limit every hour. And then on top of that, we have the safety camera vans who are detecting about 10 people an hour. So roughly 14 people an hour are detected speeding. So, you know, we will be out there. But again, to everyone, all of us are road users, look out for one another and slow down.
Assistant Garda Commissioner for Roads Policing Paula Hillman speaking there to our Northwest correspondent Eileen Magner. A new BBC investigation tells for the first time the extraordinary story of a lost American documentary made inside the Irish Republican Army in 1972, the bloodiest year of the Northern Ireland Troubles. The Secret Army was made by an American documentary crew who filmed IRA leaders and rank and file planning, preparing and carrying out bomb and gun attacks across Northern Ireland. The IRA hoped the unprecedented film would boost their support in America, but almost as soon as it was made, the film disappeared. The BBC's Dara McIntyre is the reporter on the feature-length film, also called The Secret Army. He's been telling us how the original documentary came to light.
Well, our connection goes back almost 6 years when a source handed a BBC researcher some old videotapes and suggested that we might be interested in what was on them. We got them transferred and found ourselves sitting spellbound in an edit suite, transfixed by what we were seeing. It took time, but we started to put together the story of how the film was made, and eventually we even discovered the original film reels in a back room of a New York apartment. I think it's fair to say that we were rarely less than astonished as the story emerged piece by piece.
It's clearly a film, Dara, which raises very many questions in relation to how it came to be made. It's not at all a typical documentary.
No, in many ways it's just simply quite astonishing. It is filmed inside the IRA by that American team, and we watch as IRA members prepare bombs or carry out gun attacks, often unmasked and clearly identifiable. The most iconic image, some listeners will recall from a series we did back in 2019, features Martin McGuinness, who would later lead the IRA to peace and, as a leader of a new Northern Ireland government, would meet and greet Queen Elizabeth. But here he is, handling guns and overseeing preparations for a car bombing. But this film crew had access to much more than that. They even filmed in what can only be described as classroom-type settings, where IRA members are shown how to make bombs, how to plan IRA operations, and how to handle guns and weaponry. These instructors included very senior IRA figures, shown full face with no effort at concealing their identity. Here's a taste of one of those classes where members were being shown different types of guns.
Now we'll be going into the details of this rifle and the working of this rifle later, but before we do that, I want to pass around these other weapons so we can get the feel of them. This one we're passing around now is the US Caravan. This weapon we're handing around now, the Thompson submachine gun. And I want you to get the feel of that weapon as well. This is an ideal weapon for assault groups, close-up fighting, and it's a good weapon for street fighting.
Dara, people will wonder why the IRA allowed this film to be made and in the way it was made.
Well, a good question. It's one I've pondered over a number of times the last couple of years. I think the IRA agreed to it because they wanted a propaganda boost in America. And I think the timing of the film and the filming is crucial too, because it was made in the period after Bloody Sunday, when 13 civilians were shot dead by the parachute regiment. A 14th victim would die later. At a time when the IRA leadership was coming down with recruits and when the British government had closed down the local Stormont administration. It's at a time, I think, when the IRA thought they were on course for victory. The organisation was on a high in many ways, and I think they wanted this film to document that.
Well, now, for your film, also called The Secret Army, you've gone back to some of those IRA men who featured in the original documentary and spoken to them about it. What have they been saying to you?
Well, more than 50 years on, we've been speaking to two key characters appear in the film. One of them we just heard from their running the weapons class. That's Des Long. He's a lifelong Republican from Limerick with a long history in the IRA. When the film was made, he was on the IRA's executive, close to the very top of the organisation. We did discover that some IRA leaders signed off on the film. They actually approved the final version, but Des Long had never seen it and his own cameo until we showed it to him. He now regrets having any part in it.
When they were making it, Boyle Bell told me to that, and I said, I want a mask. Oh, he says, well, I tell you, he says, you're going to be shown from the chest down. And that was a verbal promise for him, and it meant nothing. The whole thing was just, should never have been made. I'm sorry to this day I ever took part in it.
The IRA at the time, you report, were under the understanding that this would be shown in the United States, and I think there was some coverage of it given to on US television, but it actually was never shown. What happened?
Well, we don't quite know for certain, but there are at least two theories which we explore. One is that the 1972 film's portrayal of the IRA was seen as too romantic by US TV executives. The other is that the British government applied pressure on the US authorities, who in turn persuaded TV companies in the US not to show it. Of course, it would never have passed British or Irish censors at the time, so the film was in fact only seen by a few private audiences. But there's another story sitting behind the original film, and that's the exact role and knowledge of intelligence agencies. We have some compelling evidence that we share in our documentary that suggests British intelligence, but also possibly their American and Israeli counterparts, knew of the film as it was being made. I can tell you, I spent a lot of time on this project alongside producer and director John O'Kane, and we never knew exactly where it was going to take us next.
Well, Dara, people will have an opportunity to see your documentary, I think, this evening.
Yes, it's on BBC Two Northern Ireland tonight at 9 o'clock. It also will be shown again next week on Tuesday at 10 o'clock on BBC Four. For those with access to the BBC iPlayer, it's up already.
The BBC's Dara McIntyre speaking to me earlier. Back with more after this short break.
Got plans for Easter? Forget them, because Kildare Village has new brands like Gant and Millie's to discover. There's also free parking, eateries, savings at every turn, and for the little ones, an Easter egg hunt every day from Thursday to Sunday. Love Easter. Love Kildare Village. See kildarevillage.com.
Brunfer Kamer M. Dehina.
Misha Freshen.
Forest Mart, Ermahorsa, Tree Horus, Nabuinti.
Forest Mart, Tridon, Ife Krasak, the Nashunta.
Dehina by an Broad Kana Urhu, August Nakamina Kana Omrona Urhu. Tar Ervalach Nua, Quigon Game is Ansalat. Leshan OTN, Milane Fuinti Tastal, August is Fader Lat Stodder Gahachu, on Kane Kana, Ashtar Difru. Lahai Kursi Gno, Oliokta, Alchanish August Nismo, Taequig NTO Punkai. O Realtas Naharan.
RTE Radio 1.
Arcade Fire, live in concert. Plus Echo and the Bunnymen. Malahide Castle, July 7th. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie. Subject to license. Experience the band perform their debut album, Funeral, in its entirety. Plus much more. Arcade Fire. Tickets available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. Campaigners who've warned that Ireland's largest freshwater lake, Loch Ness, is in danger because of pollution have met Stormont ministers to discuss the crisis. First Minister Michelle O'Neill and Deputy First Minister Emma Little-Pengelly and the Agriculture Minister Andrew Muir attended a meeting in the County Antrim village of Toome this morning. Speaking afterwards, Michelle O'Neill said that the Northern Ireland executive had been engaged with the local stakeholders on the issue from day one of their tenure.
So it was great to meet with Loch Ness Partnership today to talk about the collective challenges that we have and those opportunities that we have for the time ahead, and again to rehearse that we are determined to do everything we can to ensure that we protect this loch, because everything that it means to the local community, because it's so beneficial to us all in so many aspects of life. So great to be here. We know there's work to do and there are plans ahead, and we are determined to do that in the executive in a joined up way, because every party around that executive table, our four party coalition, believe and understand the needs of the loch and the potential for the loch, and we're going to continue to do everything that we can.
Michelle O'Neill, let's talk to our Northern Irish Vincent Kearney now, who joins us. And Vincent, this is a long running controversy, the state of the lake, the levels of pollution in the water.
Indeed, Brian, I'm standing now outside the lock keeper's cottage where the meeting took place. When I stood here in September last year, Brad, the place was actually closed. It's run by a local charity. It was closed because of the stench from the water. People had stopped coming to it. They wouldn't come for lunch. They wouldn't even come in for tea and scone because the smell was so strong. Today it was packed with members of the campaign group, local residents were in as customers, and the politicians were here as well. So what happened was the three politicians came into a room. They met the campaigners for around an hour. During that time, the campaign group showed them a video they've made highlighting the worst of that pollution last year. And it really was, Brian, because we went out for RT News on the waters of the loch last year. The boat cut through a thick carpet of green sludge. In some places it was purple, it was blue, it was orange. Very, very highly poisonous. And campaigners warned it was killing everything around them. A number of swans died, dogs died after going into the water, eels were dying or weren't going to their full potential. Mm. And that's very important here, Brian, because there's a large eel fishery just a few hundred metres from where I'm standing. So campaigners have been very concerned. They want politicians to put this at the top of their list. So Michelle O'Neill, Emma Little-Pengelly and Andrew Muir came here today as a demonstration, a visible demonstration, if you like, of their commitment to make this a top priority.
And what's it going to take to clean up the lake?
It's going to take a long time, Brian. That's the first thing that everyone's agreed on. It's been decades in the making. The pollution is caused by too much phosphorus and too many nitrates in the water. That's been running off farmland and from other sources for many, many years. So experts, even those who say, look, we can't fix Loch Ness, are all saying this could be decades in the fixing, certainly many years. Andrew Muir, the Agriculture Minister, today said, look, we do have a plan. They're hoping to bring an action plan to the executive for agreement within the next few weeks. But he stressed this will not be a quick fix. Michelle O'Neill also stressed this will entail buy-in from the local fishing community, from the farming community and others who use the loch, because it means 400 square miles. It's bigger than the island of Malta itself. So it's a huge area, huge expanse of water. So it will take a long time to fix this problem.
Vincent Kearney at Loch Ness, thank you for that. A new service has been formed to help put Irish people living overseas back in touch with their families. The Aaron's Call project was inspired by the case of an Irishman, Joseph Gill, whose death in England in 2022 prompted a search for his family. The 86-year-old had been living in a nursing home in Birmingham and had lost touch with home. The man who helped track down his relatives is the CEO of Aaron's Call, Pádraig Grennan. He's been telling us about Joseph Gill and how the initiative came to be.
Your listeners may recall the case because it came to kind of public prominence, if you like. His remains were being held by Birmingham City Council at the time, and an appeal went out. They had a name and a date of birth and a place of birth. An appeal went out to the public in Ireland to see if anybody was the next of kin of Mr. Gill, but the details that they had were incorrect. And I noticed the appeal several times and nobody seemed to be coming forward. That's when we decided to get involved, and we quickly realised at the time that the information was incorrect. He was born in a different county and the date of birth was out by one day. So through the process of elimination, we were able to find who the correct Mr. Gill was, the correct birth certificate, and from there we could piece together and find his next of kin.
Because as a result of the commercial side of your business, you have the expertise, the experience, the contacts to be able to carry out these sort of investigations.
Well, that's it. We work for the likes of the legal profession mostly. whereby they're administering estates. They might have somebody named in a will that they can find, but they've got a scenario where there's some or no known next of kin, and we have to piece together the family tree. We present the report to the lawyers who are administering the estate, and they then can distribute the estate. So you're right. I mean, we do this in a professional capacity as opposed to like a kind of hobby genealogy, if you like, and estates are distributed based on our conclusion.
But in the case of this initiative, Aaron's Call, this is something which you're offering as a free service, pro bono.
It is indeed, and it really is. I have an interest in the Irish diaspora myself. I'm a former director or trustee of Safe Home Ireland, which provides support services to Irish immigrants overseas who are looking to return home. So I have a background with the diaspora, and obviously with the type of work we do and the expertise that we have, we felt that, you know, this service could be of real benefit to members of the diaspora overseas who are destitute, maybe don't have any family to look after them, don't have the know-how or the means to either find their family or to make their way back home in the latter stages of their life. So it is a pro bono initiative, and we hope to link in with all of the Irish immigrant support services, both in Ireland and overseas, just to raise awareness that this service exists, and we'll do it for free.
So is this then primarily aimed at people who left Ireland perhaps decades ago, who lost contact with their families and communities, but now either want to resume contact but don't know where to start, or want to actually come back home and return?
Well, it's both. That's the thing. Exactly as you say, Brian, we've people who left years ago, and people often wondered, where did my Uncle Johnny end up? They've lost contact. That individual might need help or may not want to be found is the other thing. Well, obviously, we have to respect everybody's privacy. But the other scenario is somebody who's moved away and maybe didn't have any family, things didn't work out as they would have hoped when they were leaving Ireland, and they need help then finding their family back home. So it's a two-way thing because of the way the diaspora works, the amount of Irish that are here, but obviously overseas.
You mentioned people who may not want to be found, who may not want to have contact. How can you reassure people that privacy will be respected?
Well, what we always say to anybody who contacts us in relation to any cases like this, we have to respect the privacy of the person that we're trying to find. So what we would say is if we find that individual, obviously we would explain why we're making contact and ask them if they're happy for us then to provide that person's contact details to our client, if you like. But our clients are made aware at the outset, if it's a no-no, that's the end of the process as far as we're concerned. We don't pass over the information.
Pádraig Grennan there of Aaron's Call.
Sport on RTE Radio 1.
And it's very good afternoon to Siobhan Madigan. Siobhan.
Brian, thank you. Good afternoon. The board of the FAI are meeting at Abbottstown today. The identity, though, of the new senior men's manager remains a guarded secret. But with the latest from Abbottstown, here's Dave Kelly.
The scheduled FAI board meeting commenced at 9:30. Chief Executive Jonathan Hill is in attendance. There is a growing sense that his position as CEO has been somewhat weakened following the FAI's appearance before the Public Accounts Committee last month. At that appearance, Association President Paul Cook said his confidence in Hill had been challenged, although there was support from FAI Chair Tony Cohan. The men's national team managerial vacancy will also be on the agenda. John O'Shea's two-game tenure as interim head coach ended with last night's defeat to Switzerland. The Waterford man has indicated that he is interested in succeeding Stephen Kenny.
In rugby, the Ireland women's squad are back in camp today ahead of Sunday's Six Nations clash with Italy at the RDS. Ireland lost their opening match of the championship in France, but they will be targeting a win this weekend against an Italian side who were whitewashed by champions England on Sunday. Ulster Rugby have confirmed that Hugh McCaughey will act as the interim CEO following the departure of Johnny Petrie earlier this week. McCaughey is a former provincial academy coach and will commence work next Wednesday. Eight Irish athletes will represent Ireland at this week's World Cross Country Championships in Belgrade. Fiona Everard and Danielle Donegan will go in the